Hello, I'm Mark Peterson, and this is the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast. This is episode 10. This is where we love giving well. Karen and I recently had the pleasure of hosting today's guest in our home for a few days while she did advocacy and fundraising for her organization in Canada. So rather than interviewing her by Skype, I was able to chat with her across the table. Helen Sworn lives in Cambodia. She heads up a strategic coalition that brings together 55 Christian charities dedicated to end the trafficking of people in that country. Chabdai Coalition, which means joined hands in Khmer, builds the capacity of all of its members through offering accreditation, best practice standards, streamlining programs, and advocating with government authorities. By working as a coalition, all members become stronger. The nature of this coalition means it needs to rely on donors for survival. I ask Helen about this and about her experience over the 15 years of her leading the organization. We trace these shifts that have occurred with the donors of her organization. As well, in my interview, you can hear about Helen's fascinating personal journey to get to this place today. Come join us now. Helen Sworn, you and I first met when I attended a meeting of foundations in Knoxville, Tennessee, and you were brought in to speak to the issue of anti-trafficking and how we could be involved with you. Do you remember those days?
I do. I remember sitting in that upstairs room in that downtown cafe in Knoxville, Tennessee, my first time in Tennessee. And actually my first time in speaking to a group of grant makers as well.
Wow, okay.
Very rarely do directors of charities get an opportunity to even dialogue with grant makers. So that was the first time I had ever done that.
And then shortly after that initial encounter, a group of us then went to Cambodia, where you're based, and had the opportunity to spend, I think, 5 or 6 days with you. You led us around. I think we need to wring the neck of the individual that planned that event, but it was like 5 or 6 organization visits per day.
It was
the most grueling few days of site visits that I think I've ever had.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's like you need to run on just like pure caffeine and adrenaline for like 5 days, come back, and then start to process everything in that environment. Because, yeah, it's so overwhelming, but it's just like that massive, like, catalyst of exposure of everything that's happening on the ground in as short a space as you can.
Yeah. Well, when you travel that far, you really want to take advantage of the time.
Indeed.
Yeah. So I can tell, I want to hear all about those anti-trafficking efforts, and we'll get there. But I detect from your accent that you're not from Knoxville, Tennessee.
I am not.
And I would love to know, just give us a little bit of your background. Where are you from? Tell us about your family. How did you end up in Cambodia, which is where you're located now?
Okay, so the problem is that we only have a few minutes, and I could go on for hours. So yes, originally from England. My family were from Manchester in the north of England, but I actually grew up in Bath, the very beautiful city of Jane Austen. And I'm the youngest of 5 children. And so, you know, they talk about first daughters being the strong-minded ones, but I think my sister got the kind genes and I got the kind of sassy genes at the end.
I think you got the strong-minded one. Strong-minded genes.
Yeah, it kind of waited until the end instead of at the beginning. So, yeah, so as the youngest of 5, I was, yes, pretty strong-willed and wouldn't let go of things and kept pushing to get my way in my family. But I think also I took that principle into my life. So I grew up in a family where my mother was a very strong believer and my father was an atheist. And so that was an interesting environment in the house. My mum trying to get us to church, my father trying to stop us from going to church.
Uh-huh.
So.
Wow. That push and pull.
Yeah. Very, very interesting dynamics.
So you're used to conflict then?
Yeah.
In a sense.
Sure. I think in my early days, my mum had far more influence in my life. And so I think as children then, yes, we all went to church with my mum because it was a very matriarchal northern family. And it was only in my later teenage years that I started questioning more. And interestingly, at that point that I started questioning, my father, who'd been an atheist all his life, became a Christian. Maybe about 7 or 8 years before he died. And then he was this like crazy evangelist after being an atheist all his life. So that was yeah, an interesting turn in the family.
So when the Sworn family is into something, you're all in.
All in. Yeah. And
you're all in Cambodia. What happened there?
All in Cambodia. And for me, really, it was a point in this crossroads of faith of saying, okay, God, I don't want just like a Sunday morning thing. It's like all or nothing. So either I'm going to go and open a bar in Greece, or I'm going to go and I'm going to dedicate everything that I've got in my life to this. And I did the latter. And I said, yeah. So we sold our house, packed in our jobs, and went off to seminary for 3 years. And during that time, really God opened the door to Southeast Asia. And a few years later, we hit the ground in Cambodia with a 4-year-old and a 6-month-old.
And by we, you're talking about yourself and Trevor.
Yeah. So my husband, Trevor, and our children, Hannah and Joel.
Okay. And they were little tykes back then. How old are they now?
So Hannah will be turning 22. So she's graduated from university already. She went to university in Malaysia because she just didn't feel English. And that's what happens when you've got third culture kids. And she's now moved back to Cambodia and is working in Cambodia. And Joel is coming up 18 in his last year of high school before he then embarks on a journey into university and engineering.
So what took you to Cambodia? Why there? And what did you end up doing? And tell us about that journey, because I think that's quite an interesting story.
So when we were at seminary, in our last year of seminary, we did double mission studies, and that was the time that we needed to go and do a placement overseas. And one of our professors had spent maybe 20 or 30 years in Southeast Asia, and I had a heart for Vietnam. I really thought that we were going to end up in Vietnam. And so the mission agency that we planned our short-term trip with said, well, because Vietnam is a closed country, we need you to go into Cambodia first because we have an established team there. So we went into Cambodia first.
What year was this?
This was at the beginning of 1997. So Trevor and I and Hannah was 2 years old then. And so we went into Cambodia. And I remember our very first day there. And things were a little tense. It was at the time that there was a curfew in the evenings. We arrived in the afternoon after a very long flight, and within an hour, my husband, Trevor, went off to do English teaching in a blacked-out taxi, because if he didn't go in a blacked-out taxi, he was likely to get kidnapped. And my daughter and I stayed in the mission guest house, and as the mission staff were leaving, they said, if you hear gunfire, you need to get under the bed.
This is your first day.
This is my first day. And having been brought up in, you know, in Bath, we didn't have very much gunfire. And so everybody left the building. Trevor was gone. I actually didn't even know where he was, somewhere teaching English. And so we started hearing this gunfire. And it probably was a half a mile away, but it sounded like it was right outside the window. So I am playing hide and seek games with our 2-year-old daughter. Okay, now we're going to get under the bed. And so she thought it was a great game, fortunately. I did not think it was a great game, and was quite relieved a couple of hours later when Trevor came back, and there was no gunfire after that.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was our entry into Cambodia. And then When we left Cambodia, I really felt, and our daughter contracted German measles by then as well. As we left Cambodia, I can remember saying to God, I never want to come back to this country. Like, I'm done. And we went to Vietnam. We spent some time in Vietnam looking at opportunities there. And then we went to a mission retreat place in Thailand, really just to kind of hear from God and where he was going to take us next. And it was when we were in Thailand that I was sat in this prayer meeting, arguing with God like I normally do, and saying, okay, God, if you want me, because Trevor had said, Cambodia, it's Cambodia, I really feel Cambodia. And in myself, I'm thinking, absolutely not. I do not want to go back to Cambodia. And so I'm arguing with God about Cambodia. And I said, you have to make this so clear to me that I will never doubt that this is your will for us. And as I'm sat there, I heard, and the only time ever, an audible voice behind me saying, this is the way and walk in it. And I turned around thinking that somebody had been speaking to me and there was nobody behind me. And then I read the Bible passage in Isaiah that says, whether you turn to the left or to the right, you will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way and walk in it. So that was my triplicate contract with God to go back to Cambodia. And in fact, when we arrived back in England, like 2 weeks later, it was within a month that the coup d'etat happened in 97. And everybody was saying, well, of course, you're not going to go to Cambodia now. And then it was like this complete turnaround for me. I'm like, of course, we're going to go to Cambodia. That is the only place for us to go.
Okay, so you went as a traditional type of missionary in 97 or 98 to Cambodia. But you're now involved in anti-trafficking efforts. Just what happened in that transition? There was a transition that happened as you landed on the ground and started to understand what was happening in Cambodia.
Yeah. So we landed on the ground in 99 with Hannah and Joel. And Trevor was setting up a vocational training school in IT. I decided that the only option was to start homeschooling Hannah, but I wanted to get involved in other work. I'm kind of a stir-crazy person at home. And the team that we were working in, the mission agency, had a street kids program. And they had noticed that a lot of the street kids had been disappearing through to Thailand. And we didn't really even have the language around it on trafficking. But they said, we need to understand more of what's happening. And so we're thinking of sending a research team up to the border area. Does anybody want to go? And so crazy me said, yeah, I want to go. I want to find out what's happening on the border. And I had been involved in the Street Kids program. So this was maybe just a few months after we arrived in Cambodia. So I went up with a team. The journey up there was horrendous.
Is that up to Phoi Phet?
Up to Phoi Phet. You actually couldn't go in a car between Phnom Penh and Battambang at that time. Now it's a 4-hour journey, so we had to take a little prop plane up there.
Oh, wow.
Because the road was impassable, and there was
landmines up there.
Yeah, landmines up there, which is why you couldn't drive. There were chickens on the plane. There was no door into the pilot's section at the front, so you could see everything that was happening at the front. And then as you take off, the whole of the inside of the plane, like, fills up with condensation. Like, you can't see two seats in front of you.
It's so like a mist.
It's like completely misted up. And so I was a little nervous that we were actually even going to survive the flight. But anyway, we did. And then we went in this old Land Cruiser to the border area. And again, now today, that trip would take about 2.5-3 hours. It took us about 16 hours in this old clapped out Land Cruiser on these roads that had like potholes that were about as deep as the Land Cruiser. And so I can remember going on these roads and like banging my head and like whacking my spine like all the way along and thinking, God, like, really, why did I ever volunteer to come on this trip? And I really felt like God was saying to me then, this is the journey that I'm taking you on. And it wasn't until I arrived in Phoi Phet and started to see for myself the reality of children being sold through the border, some of them through for begging, some carrying all sorts of illegal goods through the border. And then many of those children who ended up in Thailand would get picked up on the streets in the middle of the night by the Thai police, and still today actually, and deported back through the Cambodia border. And so there'll be children coming through the border the same age as my kids at the time, like a four-year-old with a six-month-old on her hip. And they'd lost their parents in this confusion of rounding everybody up and putting them through the border. And so it was at that point that my journey into anti-trafficking began.
Wow. So take us up to date now in terms of the anti-trafficking efforts. Because back in those days when you were exploring that, this wasn't even a topic of conversation, and yet we know a lot about it now.
Yeah, that's right. We hardly even had the language to describe trafficking.
Right.
I mean, it was just like, oh, these kids being sold. And I mean, there's been really positive things happening in that, you know, back then, that was 17 years ago now, there were probably about four organizations on the ground who were focused on helping these kids. And at that time, probably about 400 or 500 people a week would get deported from Thailand. Now, if you fast forward 17 years to now, and we look at the amount of exposure to human trafficking, not just in Cambodia, but globally, is huge. I mean, the media are on it. There's celebrities on it. There's documentaries about it. There's op-eds about it.
Doesn't the revenue from trafficking approach levels of drug trafficking?
Yeah.
Is that the
second to drug trafficking as a criminal network in the world?
Okay.
So there's massive amounts of money behind the criminal side. And now there's, there's in the last 17 years, there's been probably hundreds of millions of dollars that have been put into the response. And there's on the ground, there's probably about 100 more than 100 organizations just in Cambodia addressing trafficking. But you know what? Still every week, the Thai police deport up to 500 children and adults through the border.
Taking them back to Cambodia.
Yeah, deporting them, like literally taking them to the border and just pushing them through the border. So in some ways you see how much progress has been made, but still there's that underlying issue that life is not valued.
So is it an economic motivation that's really pushing these kids into Bangkok and places like that?
It is. And sometimes they'll go with their families initially, but everything is driven by economic desperation for survival.
Right.
And so people talk about choice, but choice is a word of privilege. I would rather use survival. And so these families all go through, and some of them send their children through, because if they've got 8 or 9 children, sending 2 or 3 children through to earn money in their eyes will help them keep the other children alive. Mm-hmm. And so it's a situation of survival that we can't even fathom ourselves.
We idealize a family model of, you know, mother, father, and children in a white picket fence.
Yes.
And it's not the case in rural Cambodia, where there are just economic motivations to send the kids away to earn money for the family.
And it's very easy to be highly critical.
Yeah.
But, you know, you and I have never had to make that decision.
Yeah.
We've never had to choose which children to keep alive and which children to send through the border to work. And so, yeah, it's economic desperation.
Is there a sexual element to it as well?
Yeah. I mean, in the early days, it was the sex trafficking that caught the eyes and ears of the media and of the global public. And, if we look at the last 17 years, we do have a lot of the sex trafficking and labor trafficking that that actually interplay with one another. So quite often you'll get children who may primarily be trafficked for labor, for example, selling things on the streets of Bangkok, but then very easy for them to get picked up by somebody who will then sell them for sex.
Right.
So we tend not to separate now sex trafficking and labor trafficking as far as our own programs are concerned, because we see so many situations where they're interconnected. And also, I think it's important to see that whether they're victims of sex trafficking or whether they're victims of labor trafficking, we don't put one above another. They need care, they need protection, they need hope, whatever environment of exploitation they've come out of.
Help us understand your model that you're using in Cambodia and in other places. So we've talked a bit about the trafficking issue and the environment. Mm. Tell us about your response.
Mm. Well, as I said, when the media got hold of this issue, one of the positive things that happened was, especially in North America, we saw a lot of individuals, Christian NGOs and others coming to the ground and saying, I want to be a part of the response. I want to be able to help to address this issue of trafficking. Many of them came to the ground and set up aftercare shelters. So there was a huge focus. Actually, that was when the US government's first trafficking in persons grants were issued into Cambodia in 2002 for aftercare. And so we started seeing all of these groups set up. But one of the challenges that happened on the ground was then these groups were setting up in silos. They had, you know, a great sense of responsibility and passion about addressing it, but they weren't aware of the broader issues on the ground. They weren't aware of who was doing what on the ground. So we started getting all these different siloed responses. And it's a little bit like, you know, when you have a disaster or crisis situation and you get all of these organizations to the ground in those early days, coordination is critical. If you don't have coordination when you have a disaster response, you get some families who may get 4 or 5 meals a day and others who'll starve.
Right.
Some who may get 2 or 3 shelters and some who won't get any shelter. And so, you know, the way that those disaster response organizations work is that they have to coordinate. For the sake of the beneficiaries, they have to coordinate it. And so I came from a corporate background myself in strategic planning and management. And even though that was kind of my pre-Christian time, God really brought all of that knowledge back to me and said, use that knowledge that I've given you to now help these people work together. And so that's really the rationale behind it. I got those groups together and said, okay, first of all, this is a criminal network. The only way that we're going to address a networked problem is with a network solution. So we have to work together. And then the second thing is, and I brought together faith-based organizations, I said, actually, we're mandated to work together as the body of Christ. So whether we want to or not, this is a part of our mandate. Mm. But it took a year and a half to get those groups around the table in the beginning.
Wow.
And so...
And this is in the early 2000s.
So this was in 2003, 2004, I started trying to get the groups around the table. And
who were the earliest ones around that table?
Yeah, so IJM had just come in. World Vision had been in a few years. Hagar were on the ground. There were a few bigger groups. There weren't a lot of small groups at that time, but there were literally organizations and groups coming into Cambodia by the month. There was this massive influx. And so what we did is we got around the table to look at what were the issues, who was doing what in every sector, where are the gaps? Where are the overlaps? And so what came out of that was a referral mechanism. There wasn't a national referral mechanism for victims. And so we got the organizations around the table and looked at what kind of shelters did we need for these victims? What kind of services did we need for these victims? And really got those groups focused on that. And the other thing was, one of the massive challenges in Cambodia, because of its civil war history, is education and the lack of it. And so these groups were setting up shelters and programs, but there weren't any qualified social workers, counselors, psychologists. And so we know that you're only going to be able to provide good victim care if you've got staff who've got the knowledge.
Right.
So one of the main mandates for us as CHAPDAI was actually to do capacity building and training of national staff in order to provide good care and services to victims.
And how has your coalition then grown since those early days?
Yeah, so those early days, we had about 10 organizations around the table. Right now, we've got 55 member organizations, which is a mix of international charities and local charities. And we spend a lot of time really strategizing the big picture of what's happening, not just in Cambodia, but in the region. I say that trafficking and exploitation crosses all the borders. It crosses moral borders, spiritual borders, but it also crosses geographic borders. And so really helping those groups to see the big picture of what it is that they need to address. So that's what we're doing with the larger sector now.
Let's turn our attention to discussing philanthropy. Mm. And CHAPDAI and the CHAPDAI Coalition relies on philanthropy as its model for revenue. Paint us a picture for what this looks like for you. Mm. Who are the donors to this initiative?
Yeah. It's very interesting because I think that the traditional framework of anti-trafficking to the donor community is looking at direct client care and direct client services. Mm-hmm. And so
we all want to dig a well, don't
all
we?
Want to dig a well, all want to help that, you know, 10-year-old girl in a shelter. Yeah. And but some of that is quite short-term focused, and some of that doesn't build the foundation for long-term change and long-term sustainable programming. And so when I founded CHAPDAI, one of the main challenges was actually getting funding for a coalition. And I joke because I can remember meeting with one of our early donors in the States, and him introducing our program and saying, okay, well, the coalition that we fund in Cambodia is probably one of our least sexy projects that we fund. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew them quite well and I was able to laugh at this, but I said, actually, that's part of the problem, that different programs receive different values. And a coalition is not seen to have the same value level as a shelter or a direct service provider. Yet, the indirect beneficiaries of a coalition are thousands more than direct service.
Right.
But it doesn't look great on a donor portfolio. Hmm. It doesn't look great in a news article and media piece. It's like, okay, well, so you train people and you build capacity. It's not very exciting.
I think it looks great on a donor portfolio.
Oh.
So I'm just saying, from my perspective, it looks great because there is a way through donating to CHAPDAI that I'm really benefiting 55 organizations.
Indeed.
Plus all of the impact that they're generating through their work, you know.
Yeah.
And so I've always considered it to be a great opportunity to leverage my giving.
That's amazing, because I think that sometimes that's not how the donor community has thought about charity.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that, you know, people talk about the need for coalition models globally, but I know even from talking to other coalitions around the world, they find exactly the same problem.
Hmm.
They could fund an aftercare shelter tomorrow, but the coalition just doesn't have that same pull.
Right.
And but it's such a critical piece of the long-term sustainable environment that we're looking at.
In an earlier interview I did with Michael Van Pelt from Cardis, he and I were chatting about And CARDIS is a think tank, so it's not digging wells. He and I chatted about the idea of patient capital.
Right.
That might be something to hang your hat on with what you're doing at the Coalition.
Yes, that's really interesting, patient capital. And I think that that actually pushes back against what everybody's talking about, scaling up. And so I had a discussion with somebody just a couple of weeks ago, and they said, so, you know, we've scaled up feeding programs and we've scaled up education programs. And so how do we scale this up? And so I said, so if you have a program where you're serving, you know, 50 women who have been exploited, what does scale up look like? Does that mean serving 200 women in not quite such a professional and deep way? Or do you go deeper? So, you know, a lot of people talk about scale up is broader and bigger. But actually, I'm like, well, maybe scaling up is scaling down and you go deeper.
Yeah.
And so I like that because that fits in with what you were talking about, the patience level.
Yeah. Your organization has around 45 employees, I think.
Just over 50 now.
Over 50. And you work with 55 partners.
Mm-hmm.
That's a considerable challenge. Your philanthropy for the Coalition, though, is built around a model that has attracted very few institutional partners to kind of collaborate with you, giving fairly large sums of money to make it all happen.
Yeah.
And then all of your Coalition partners also contribute member dues and that sort of things. No, they don't.
No.
Okay.
No.
I was incorrect on that.
Yeah. We explored that, but we realized as well that there are a lot of small organizations that we serve on the ground who would struggle to pay funds. And
do your larger partners contribute?
They don't, but what we have actually done now is that they will contribute to things like certain training programs, and when they come to the member conferences they contribute, but it's a small amount because we know that so many of them are struggling on the ground themselves in raising funds. So what we've tried to do, and it's not sustainable anyway, even if you get small member dues. So we've tried to see that this is actually our mission to the organizations on the ground.
Okay.
And so we don't get member dues.
So tell us your philanthropic strategy then. Mm. How do you raise money and who from?
Yeah. So, I think that it's changed over history. Mm-hmm. So in the early days, small Christian foundations were those that were prepared to almost risk that funding into an unknown model.
Right.
So we saw smaller Christian foundations put in. As the years have gone on, we've actually secured a little bit of European government money. And then some broader money from some groups actually in Asia. So it's been interesting to see the donor model of funding the Coalition change. So now we actually have less and less Christian foundations funding the Coalition model, even though the Coalition model works with Christian organizations. And so I think that sometimes it's people struggle to see where it fits because we're trying to raise the technical levels of care in Cambodia and be more strategic about that. But also we're trying to support and encourage one another within the Christian sector. And so some people are like, well, is it Christian enough or not Christian enough? And so it's actually interesting to see that donors have trying to work out where it fits within their own Christian philanthropy vision.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, we've always said we're very strongly Christian in our roots, but you know, in our programming, we're not trying to deliver evangelical programs. We're not trying to proselytize. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is raise the standard of care.
Right.
And I think that that's where it doesn't quite fit into any of the boxes.
Yeah. I think many smaller faith-based initiatives lead with their hearts.
Mm.
And you're trying to model a different way of leading with your head. It doesn't mean you don't have a heart. You have a heart, but it's integrated, I think.
Yes. And I think that, yes, taking that strategic business model and laying it within a coalition of Christian organizations, again, it doesn't kind of fit into the boxes so well. There are some philanthropists who I think are far, far broader in wanting to see long-term investment in a country. And so those kind of philanthropists, I think this fits really well.
You had Equitas Group in Knoxville, Tennessee, being one of those, I would say.
Absolutely.
Who, over a long period of time, invested in you and your vision.
Yeah. And I think that what I valued about that was that they were looking to invest in innovative, small grassroots programs that maybe didn't have a massively long proven track record. Maybe it didn't fit into the traditional kind of media framework of an anti-trafficking organization, but they saw the underlying long-term value in building a coalition. And so, yeah, they were one of the ones that came along in the early days.
You mentioned coalition just now, and as you know, one of my visions and interests is the idea of building coalitions. I love the power of a coalition. So whether it's working in anti-trafficking efforts, we're stronger when we're together.
For sure.
Or when we're working in philanthropy,
yeah,
we are also stronger when we're together. And would really value your thoughts and insight into what can we learn in our philanthropy about coalition building that you've learned over your 15, 20 years of doing this in Cambodia?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I think that the coalition model in whatever sector is the most strategic way of seeking the vision that you're mandated to seek. I think a few reasons of that. I think that once you build this coalition model, what we've learned is that a lot of organizations and, you know, even companies and philanthropists, you only see your perspective of the issue, your perspective of the response. And it's almost like, you know, in the old dance halls, you would get those big glass model balls that would hang from the ceiling.
You mean like a mirror ball?
Yeah, like the big mirror balls, yeah?
Okay. When you said dance hall, I went back 100 years,
yeah,
not to the
1980s. I'm sorry. Yeah, my perspective.
Okay.
And so you see like only like this little piece. And
yeah.
And then when you start standing back with others, you start to see, oh, that is their perspective and their perspective. And you begin to get a holistic framework of what it is that you're working in that one organization and one person can never, ever do. However intelligent they are, however much experience they've got, you will only see what you can see.
Right.
And so what we've been able to really learn from having a coalition is suddenly we get the big picture. So organizations are saying, well, we've seen this change and we've seen this change and we've seen this model work. And it increases the community knowledge. So it's not just about my organization, my projects, but actually you start broadening out and saying, this is about community. This is about learning as a community. Of course, it's going to benefit each individual organization, but it's also about giving and receiving. So, you know, if I'm working in a particular set area and then somebody else comes to the table and I can share my knowledge with them and they can share their knowledge with me, it increases my impact. And so I think that that has been a massive piece as I look at the community. And then what begins to happen when you have this more cohesive and strategic response, you get a much a far more increased level of influence. So each of us has our own circle of influence, you know, if we're looking at the Stephen Covey model. But then when we put all of those influence factors together, you start seeing that actually you have a massive circle of influence. Mm. And so whether that's in philanthropy or whether that's in charity, you start seeing that actually you have a greater voice, not just of what you're doing on the ground, but you have a greater voice of advocacy. You have a greater voice to educate others. And it just, it's, you know, increasing the sum of its parts.
For me, it's all about stewardship.
Right.
You know, and by working together, we steward better.
Right. For sure. I love the fact that you're looking at that from a, you know, a philanthropist perspective, because I see, as from a charity director's perspective, we also have to be good stewards. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I see it from a coalition perspective that we can be much better stewards of our money and time and resources if we pool them.
Speaking from a charity perspective, what advantages do you see of coalitions of philanthropists?
Mm. Well, as I said, the first experience that I had in Knoxville, Tennessee, of meeting all of you, was I realized that all of you, even in that room together, as we were discussing the issues around trafficking and responses, that the exchange of knowledge sharpens each of us.
Right.
And so, and I think that if you look at that within the field of philanthropy, you can either just follow the biggest donor, and that if they all say put money into aftercare, then everybody follows them and puts money into aftercare. Or you can have these great minds around the table, just as you guys all were, and it sharpens mm-hmm. your perspective and challenges your perspective as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if one says, oh, well, of course we're going to fund shelters for 5-year-old, then somebody else said, well, what about prevention? Well, what about education? What about employment and setting up small businesses? And it sharpens our perspective and challenges us, rather than us just like saying, well, this is my knowledge and my perspective, and I don't need to expand that or have that challenged in any other way. And I think that having that within a donor and or philanthropy coalition is what I've seen has been the best, as I've seen you guys and Equitas and other organizations sit around the table and debate these issues. I think ultimately the people that we're here to serve are going to be much better served.
Going forward, how would you hope to have Canadians contribute to your program?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I see that we all have a responsibility within the global village that we're in, and we've developed some amazing partners here on the ground, actually in Canada, who help support our programs on the ground in Cambodia. So, you know, there's amazing charities out there, such as Ratanak Foundation, such as Hope for the Nations, 10th Church, who are all Canadian charity organizations, and all of whom are able to be conduits for funding into Cambodia for our programs.
And for Americans and British?
Yeah, for Americans, we actually have a 501c3 registration already as CHAPDAI. So people can give directly to CHAPDAI in the US. And in the UK, we also have a charitable registration, so people can give direct to CHAPDAI in the UK as well.
Great.
Thanks, Helen, for the work you do, for your resilient spirit and your dedication to this challenging cause. I hope all of you listening are as inspired as I am today. You can connect with Helen and CHAPDAI through the links in the show notes. They need our financial support, and as I said during the interview, I can't think of a more strategic investment for one's philanthropy. Also, I completely forgot to ask Helen about one of her latest initiatives, so I'll fill you in on it here and give you a link in the show notes. Freedom Collaborative is a way to leverage the power of coalitions across international borders. It's an online hub for information and resources for anyone, charity, community agency, philanthropist, who is interested in combating the prevalence of trafficking in countries around the world. Look at the show notes for the link to this site. That concludes today's podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our website at strongerphilanthropy.ca, or find us on iTunes or on your Android podcatcher apps. If you want to reach out, feel free to connect by email at strongerphilanthropy@gmail.com. You can message me on Twitter at lovegivingwell, or on Facebook at Stronger Philanthropy. Buen camino.